Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and lots going on in Washington today, starting with the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. He was asked by senators how he'd rule in cases involving money in politics, gun rights, and more. Here's Democrat Dianne Feinstein questioning Gorsuch on whether he thought the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion was so entrenched in law that it couldn't be overturned.
Do you view Roe as having super precedent?
Well, Senator, super precedent is a
in numbers, 44.
It has been reaffirmed many times. I can say that. Yes.
Yes, dozens. Yeah.
Well, meanwhile, just days from an expected vote on the Republican plan to replace Obamacare, President Trump went to Capitol Hill today to try and get more Republicans on board. Let's bring in Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Jeremy.
And lots to get through here, but let's start with the Gorsuch hearings. Here's another moment. The Republican chairman of the committee, Chuck Grassley, was asking about judicial independence and whether Gorsuch would have any trouble ruling against President Trump. Here's Gorsuch's response.
So that's a softball, Mr. Chairman. I have no difficulty ruling against or for any party other than based on what the law and the facts in the particular case require. And I'm heartened by the support I have received from people who recognize that there's no such thing as a Republican judge or a Democratic judge. We just have judges in this country.
Ron, what does that answer and the other answers we've heard from Gorsuch today tell you about how he's handling himself today on Capitol Hill?
He's doing well, Jeremy. He's saying the things he needs to say, wants to say, is supposed to say. Now, whether or not we're really getting much of an idea of where Neil Gorsuch lives in terms of his legal philosophy, where it applies to politically sensitive cases, that's another story. That's oftentimes a little unclear. His answers to, for example, Dianne Feinstein, the tape you just played, not really clear what he was saying in those answers. There was another exchange with her, another with Senator Patrick Leahy, another with Senator Lindsey Graham, where you could read different things into his answers. And that is probably precisely the idea. That's just what he and the people who have trained him and coached him in how to get confirmed have been talking about.
Did he reveal anything today then about how he would rule on controversial issues?
Well, you could say that he made it very clear that he did not consider himself under any obligation to always rule in favor of what Donald Trump wants or might indicate he wanted. And he made it very clear he did not promise Donald Trump that he would vote any particular way on any particular issue as the price of getting this nomination. He rejected that idea, and when asked whether or not he had promised to vote, for example, to overturn Roe versus Wade, he said, if he had asked me that, I would have walked out the door of the Oval Office. Hmm.
Meanwhile, Ron, on health care, this morning President Trump reportedly told lawmakers in a private meeting, I believe many of you will lose in 2018 if the GOP health care overhaul is not passed. We're hearing about some deals that have been made with conservatives to bring them on board, one with New York Republicans that would shift Medicaid costs from counties to the entire state. What's going on with this health care bill? Other backroom deals? Are those kinds of things more to come?
Yes. And that's just to get it through the House. If we were to actually get it over to the Senate, then you would probably see backroom deals on a far greater scale on a number of issues as the price of poker in the Senate. But let's start here with the House. The concessions that have been made thus far are primarily around the edges. There was a deal for New York lawmakers from upstate New York who wanted to see some changes in the way that state would have its Medicaid handled. There were also a number of people who wanted to see the expansion of Medicare pulled back and pulled back faster. Medicaid pulled back faster, and that would be restricted on a shorter time frame. And also another big one was the acceleration of the elimination of some of the Obamacare taxes from 2018 to this year, which would be a huge boon, a huge tax break, particularly for the wealthiest taxpayers.
And then last night, Trump had a rally in Kentucky, and he said something else that they're not even talking about, it doesn't seem like, in this health care bill. Let's take a listen. He's talking about negotiating lower drug prices.
Medicine prices will be coming way down, way, way, way down, and that's going to happen fast. And we're just adding that to the bill. I said we got to add that to the bill. We're going to do a bill later. We're trying to add it to this bill. And if we can't, we're going to have it right after.
Now, that would be a pretty big deal, Ron, if they were going to do that. Is there talk of that?
There's talk of it from Donald Trump. There's talk of it from the White House. There are probably a lot of Democrats who would like that idea. Not so many Republicans are sold on that idea, particularly because of the way that it would have to be done. So it is not part of the changes that have been agreed to for the House bill. And it is probably not going to be something that can be passed without the cooperation of Democrats, because it's not going to be able to be attached to the legislation at this stage. And that means it'll have to get 60 votes from Democrats. But maybe it'll be more popular among Democrats in the Senate than it is among Republicans. So we'll see what happens with that. But this threat that the president made, that's going to get a lot of attention, that either you vote for this bill on Thursday night or you're going to lose in 2018. He's talking there about primary challenges, I believe, because many of these Republicans' constituencies are saying, gee, we just wanted a clean Obamacare repeal. We didn't want this whatever it is that's coming down the pike where, for example, we're hearing people in rural areas, older people, people who are unemployed and lower income might actually have a harder time with higher premiums than they have under the current system, including Obamacare. So that could be a threat to some of those Republicans. And Donald Trump may be implying that they're going to see some kind of a more conservative opponent if they don't go along with this bill.
That's Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Ron, it's going to be a busy week. I'm sure we'll be talking to you again. Thanks so much.
Looking forward to it, Jeremy.
Well, a disturbing story now from Venezuela. People in this oil-rich country are being forced to change their diets because of food shortages. And as meat, milk, and pasta run out, many Venezuelans are filling up on yuca, the cheap, starchy root. But with demand soaring, some Venezuelans are mistakenly eating a toxic variety of the root vegetable, with sometimes fatal consequences. Reporter John Otis has more.
At a Caracas cemetery, Tulio Linares does some last-minute landscaping at the grave of a relative who's just been buried. In recent days, he's come to this cemetery four times to bury his 19-year-old son, his sister-in-law, and two brothers-in-law. After eating what's known here as bitter yucca, all four suffered stomach cramps and severe vomiting and died last month. One died on Saturday, another died on Sunday, Linares says. First one was buried, then the next. Over the past 6 months, 28 Venezuelans have died after unwittingly eating the poisonous plant. The death toll is another grim marker of Venezuela's economic crisis. Due to low oil prices, the government has less cash to import food. Meanwhile, experts say state takeovers of farms and factories have driven down domestic food production. The resulting shortages are damaging Venezuelans' health, according to a new survey by the country's three top universities. It found that 75% of the population has lost an average of 19 pounds. Maritza Landaeta, a doctor who worked on the survey, says people weak from hunger are even more susceptible to cyanide poisoning from bitter yucca. Bitter yucca looks almost identical to its more common cousin, sweet yucca, which is usually boiled or fried like potatoes. But there's a key difference. Bitter yucca contains high levels of cyanide. It's used in some foods, but only after being processed. I visit a rustic outdoor kitchen just east of Caracas that churns out cassava bread. It's made with bitter yucca. But first, workers take out the bad stuff. After soaking pieces of bitter yucca in water, workers put them in a homemade press and extract a milky white liquid containing cyanide. The now toxin-free yucca is ground into flour and cooked into crispy rounds of cassava bread. Rosalia Franco, who runs the cassava kitchen, has been growing bitter yucca for decades. She says cases of poisoning used to occur once every 20 years. The problem now, Franco says, is that desperate people have started robbing yucca fields, but they often don't know whether they've dug up sweet or bitter yucca and end up eating the toxic roots or selling them at outdoor markets. TV news programs now offer consumer tips on how to tell the difference between bitter and sweet yucca. Bitter yucca, for example, has slightly thicker skin. But that information apparently didn't reach Tulio Linares' family, whose 22 members live together in a Caracas slum. Catherine Linares, Tulio's daughter, thinks her uncle Jose inadvertently purchased bitter yucca on the street, then cooked it for the rest of the household. Jose was the first of the four Linares family members to fall ill and die. For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Caracas, Venezuela.
Journalist Kurt Eichenwald has been a frequent guest on this program. We'll link you to his visit, critical of President Trump's business interests, at hereandnow.org. It's reporting that's drawn social media attacks from the right. But a couple months ago, a tweet sent him into a seizure. Now, Eichenwald has written about being an epileptic. In December, an animated image in a tweet pulsed like a strobe light over the message, "You deserve a seizure for your posts." He immediately suffered one. This past Friday, the FBI arrested the man they say sent the tweet, John Rain Ravello, and charged him with criminal cyberstalking with the intent to kill or cause bodily harm. On Monday, the DA's office in Dallas County, where Eichenwald lives, also charged Ravello with felony assault with a hate crime enhancement. Now, this could be the first criminal case of someone using technology to injure a medically vulnerable person. Eichenwald can't talk about it because it's ongoing. So we're joined by his attorney, Steve Lieberman. He's with the law firm Rothwell Figg. Full disclosure, he's represented NPR in legal disputes in the past. Steve, welcome.
Thank you for having me here, Robin.
So tell us about the seizure. How severe was it? He'd written about how he got another tweet earlier in the fall and dropped his laptop and did not get a seizure when he saw this kind of strobe coming. In December, he did. What happens?
It was an extremely serious seizure. An epileptic who has a seizure of this sort, that seizure can be fatal if it lasts long enough. Here, Kurt was completely incapacitated while the seizure was going on. Was largely unable to function the next several days and is showed residual physical and mental effects from the seizure for a couple of months after that. This was a serious, life-threatening incident.
All right. Well, and a horrifying thought. We, frankly, are appalled to hear that hackers have done this to the Epilepsy Foundation website, that medical device makers are warning it could be done to insulin pumps or oxygen tanks. They could be hacked and harm someone. Will that be part of your argument? I mean, what are you arguing here?
The principal point is that what was done to Kurt was a physical attack on a person that the assailant knew to be vulnerable to a particular type of attack with the intent to injure or to kill Kurt. It would be like mailing a bomb to somebody, or to bring the point home with respect to a reporter, imagine that a reporter writes a story, leaves the building at night, and somebody comes up behind him and hits him on the head with an iron bar. This was no different.
Well, couldn't the argument be made that it was different because it was words? It was words about what Kurt Eichenwald had written. It was a response to something he had written. It was freedom of speech through that's what Twitter is. That's what our president does on a daily basis. He tweets. Take that point first.
Right. So no doubt that's the argument that will be made on his behalf. And if all that happened, if all that was sent was a message saying, "You deserve a seizure for your posts," with no strobe light, that would not have been a criminal act. That would be constitutionally protected speech. What makes this a criminal act is the sending of a flashing strobe light, which has no expressive content at all and is sent solely for the purpose of causing injury or causing death.
Yeah. Well, what about the way Mr. Ravello was tracked down? Again, it was an anonymous tweet. It was sent using a prepaid phone and SIM card. But authorities had help from both Twitter and Apple. They got warrants to track down information that they found in the iCloud that traced them to Mr. Ravello. Do you think that that will hold up in court?
Well, I think it absolutely will. Companies like Apple and Twitter cooperate every day with law enforcement authorities when they're trying to identify people who have committed crimes. Here, Ravello worked very hard to try to maintain his anonymity, purchasing a throwaway cell phone, sending his tweet anonymously. But the authorities were diligent in tracking him down.
Well, so cautionary tale there. That you can't possibly hide the trail. But others are tweeting your client. Eichenwald says he's had dozens more tweets sent to him with similar images since this incident. Of course, he's trying to protect himself now by not opening them. Are they being investigated as well?
You'd have to ask the FBI and the Dallas District Attorney's Office, but I would certainly think that continuing this type of behavior with respect to Kurt or anyone who has epilepsy is the height of foolishness in light of the arrest of John Ravello.
Is that part of what you hope to have happen with this case? If, in fact, he is found to be guilty, to send the message that, you know, you got to stop this. I mean, how does Kurt work without, you know, being afraid of his tweets?
Right. So I would say there are two principal purposes from Kurt's point of view. One is to stop this sorts of behavior with respect to epileptics. And number two, to make sure that people understand that physical attacks on journalists are just out of bounds. You can disagree with journalists vehemently, even in very offensive language, but you cannot attack a journalist any more than you can attack another citizen.
Well, I would think part of the message, too, would be you can't attack a medically compromised person. I mean, again, it's just stunning that the Epilepsy Foundation is getting these tweets.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the intent here, as reflected by what the FBI has included and the affidavit in support of the search warrant, is very clear. The electronic information on Mr. Ravello's device has included statements like, "I hope this sends him into a seizure," "spammed this at Eichenwald, let's see if he dies." This person intended to injure or possibly to kill Kurt. That is just completely unacceptable.
That's attorney Steve Lieberman representing reporter Kurt Eichenwald. A man has been charged with sending Eichenwald a weaponized tweet. So there are criminal charges, but Lieberman and Eichenwald are also considering a civil lawsuit. All proceeds from that would go to charities that benefit people with epilepsy. Steve, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
The Trump administration has stepped up enforcement of the country's immigration laws, which has led to some high-profile deportations of people who've lived in the U.S. for years. Now, some parents who are here illegally but whose children are U.S. citizens are taking steps to prepare in case they're deported. Joy Diaz of Here and Now contributor Texas Standard reports.
Veronica Avila Zavala is a mother of two, a 9-year-old girl and a 7-year-old boy.
La niña tiene 9 y el niño tiene 7.
The girl is a firecracker, Avila Zavala says. Not the boy. He's normally very mellow. This past November, tragedy struck the family. Avila Zavala's partner and the father of her children was murdered in Mexico.
Lo deportaron el 28 de octubre. Lo mataron el 23 de noviembre. O sea, nomás tenía 15 días allá.
He was deported at the end of October, and she says within 2 weeks, a local gang in his small town of southern Mexico had killed him. They believed he had money since he was coming from the U.S. Now, her biggest fear is that she could be deported too. I am afraid, she says, if I am deported, who's going to take care of my kids? The state? The foster care system? It's estimated the unauthorized immigrant population in Texas is about 1.5 million people. Since so many could be affected by new parameters for deportations, the Consulate of Mexico and other nonprofits are providing free law clinics for parents across Texas. The idea is to help them fill out and notarize powers of attorney on behalf of their children. At the Mexican consulate in Austin recently, attorney Daniela Lytle told parents the documents are not living wills and they are not custody orders.
It's really not a long-term document. It's meant to be a Band-Aid until a court order is in place. That's how
they still need to go through the court.
They still need to go to the court if custody has to be established. This is just something in place to have in the event of a very quick emergency.
Say, for instance, the parents are picked up by immigration agents while at work. The power of attorney allows someone the parents trust to pick up their children from school. Or if the kids were to get sick, the power of attorney allows the new guardians to make medical decisions on behalf of the children. Waiting in line outside the consulate was Magdalena Tercero. She's a mother of three who came to the clinic with her friend Heather Hoff. Tercero asked Hoff to be her children's guardian in case she and her husband are deported. She's the only person I trust with my children, she says, because I don't have relatives in the United States. Tercero says that as a child, she was close friends with Hoff's husband, and since he married Hoff, Tercero and Hoff became friends too. The grown-ups are inseparable, and so are their children.
They play a lot together too. We hang out probably like every other weekend, and our kids always play together.
If the Terceros were to be deported, Hoff and her husband would be taking in three children on top of the two they already have.
I mean, they've done a lot for us, so I'm sure they would do the same for us if the roles were switched.
Both women are clearly shaken by the step they're about to take, but they're certain signing that power of attorney is the right thing to do. For Here and Now, I'm Joy Diaz in Austin.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 200 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 500 companies and hundreds of thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
There is a big fight going on over golf balls. The discount retailer Costco is suing Acushnet Holdings Corporation. That's the parent company of Titleist. Last year, when Costco started selling low-priced golf balls that were favorably compared to Titleist's best-selling balls, the Costco balls flew from the shelves and sold out. Now Costco and Titleist are in a legal battle over those golf balls. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us now. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
So these Kirkland Signature golf balls from Costco caused a big splash with golfers and also ruffled some feathers. Can you walk us through the history and explain how this lawsuit came about?
You bet. So Costco began selling these balls under, as you said, the Kirkland Signature brand, its generic brand, in 2016 at $30 for two dozen balls. That comes to $1.25 a ball, made them one of the cheapest ones on the market. They got a favorable review, as you mentioned, and as a result, they were just flying off the shelves. Well, then Acushnet, they came back with what Costco describes as a threatening letter, saying that Costco violated its patent rights and engaged in false advertising when Costco said that its signature Kirkland balls meet or exceed the quality standards of leading national brands. So Costco's argument against these alleged patent infringements are twofold. One, they say no infringements occurred, and two, those 11 patents are invalid.
Well, and when we're talking about patent infringement, how different are golf balls from each other? Because I'm not a golfer, but when I look at them, they all look about the same to me.
I'm not a golfer either, but I did speak with a source who actually happens to be my dad, who actually happened to have purchased many of these Kirkland balls. He says that they traveled further. So I think that's about as scientific as it gets, is my father saying that they traveled further than various other brands. But he said, you know, for amateur golfers like him, it probably doesn't make that huge of a difference. But again, they're being compared favorably against what is considered the top of the line golf ball. And who doesn't want to give themselves every advantage they can when they're out there playing?
Well, and it sounds like one of the things that's happening here is that Acushnet, which is Titleist's parent company, as we said, has gone after a lot of other golf ball makers and has done very well when they have challenged those makers in court. But in this case, it's Costco, which is a huge company that is going up against them. They might actually be successful.
Right. As one analyst said, this is a duel between 800-pound gorillas. But back in 2015, Acushnet sued 10 small companies, and that was over them allegedly infringing on patents for their dimple patterns. And those cases were dismissed last year, but some of the companies settled and some of them folded rather than fight in court.
So it's those dimple patterns. Those are the important parts of the golf ball.
Dimples, and it's not making Acushnet smile, that's for sure.
Okay, so the Costco golf balls sold out last year. Costco pulled the listing from its website. Do they plan to sell them again?
Well, as a matter of fact, Costco says that it plans to sell the balls again in the future. And if that's true, that could affect the going rate for them on eBay, where many people decide, let's buy these things up while we can.
That's Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal. Jason, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
After James Comey revealed yesterday that the FBI is investigating any cooperation between the Trump campaign and Russia in the U.S. election, Congressman Adam Schiff, the ranking Democratic member of the House Intelligence Committee, asked his own questions. We know former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort was a paid consultant to pro-Russian interests in Ukraine, but why, Schiff asked, did Trump advisor Carter Page go to Russia in the middle of the campaign? How did longtime advisor Roger Stone, who boasted about communicating with WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and Guccifer 2.0, the hacker who U.S. officials think is Russian, how did Stone know that there would be more email releases? Stone spoke today on CBS This Morning about his interaction with Guccifer.
I wrote a long piece for Breitbart News on Guccifer, and I think you will see that my exchange with him is entirely benign. It is the only exchange with him that I have had. I've made it public, both the private tweets and the direct messages.
Yesterday, Congressman Schiff said all of these Russian contacts could be benign coincidence, or they could be Russian techniques used in other countries. Philip Bump is national correspondent for The Washington Post. He joins us by Skype for a primer on some of these names we're hearing. And Philip, in mid-June, the Democrats disclosed that Russian hackers penetrated the DNC. Hillary Clinton's stolen emails appeared in July. Start with Roger Stone's comments in August.
Sure. So it's important to remember about Roger Stone that Roger Stone is a bit of a showman, that he absolutely would love to portray himself as being more intimately involved in things than he necessarily was. Mm-hmm. It's also the case that he's been an ally of Trump's for a long time. That's necessary context. And mm-hmm. at the time, he was running an independent super PAC, so he couldn't actually talk to Trump theoretically under mm-hmm. the law. So all of that said, mm-hmm. with that, all that throat clearing done, mm-hmm. Roger Stone apparently had, at the time that these emails had been released by WikiLeaks, Roger Stone seemed to be somewhat prescient about it, saying that John Podesta was going to be next in the barrel.
John Podesta, the Democratic operative, yep.
Yes, exactly, the chair of Hillary Clinton's campaign. He seemed to have inside knowledge about what was coming down the pike, and at one point in time said that he had a mutual friend with WikiLeaks' Julian Assange that made him privy to information about what was coming. But then, as attention started to focus on Stone and his role and his interaction with the Russians, he tried to say that it was all innocuous, that he didn't actually have any sort of connection at all, which I think is also very typical for Roger Stone.
Well, then now take us on to Paul Manafort. Trump's former campaign manager has very explicit ties with especially the Ukraine. We can fill that out a little bit more. But after this announcement of an investigation into any possible ties between the Trump campaign and Russia, Sean Spicer, Donald Trump's spokesperson, backpedaled like crazy on Paul Manafort's role in the campaign. So did several spokespersons on cable TV last night. Oh, he was really only there for a couple of days. What was his right. role in the campaign?
Well, I mean, he was the campaign chairman. I mean, he had a very significant role if you say to me, this person is the person that is the chairman of the campaign, it's not a normal campaign title, mind you, but it certainly suggests that this is a person who's in charge of the campaign. Manafort was a spokesperson for the campaign for months on end. You may remember there was this very famous dispute between him and Corey Lewandowski, the first campaign manager for the Trump campaign. Manafort was in charge of the Trump effort essentially from the primaries through the convention. So he sort of shepherded that middle ground. In part, the reason I think it's important to remember that Manafort got fired was that there were revelations that came out about his interactions with the Ukrainian government and the outgoing president of Ukraine, who had the support of Russia at the time that Ukraine was going through its political revolution. So that was actually the thing that triggered Manafort being fired, was the closeness of his relationship to Russia that inspired Trump to finally pull the trigger on getting rid of him.
Well, there was a very funny moment on cable last night where on CNN where Anderson Cooper and Dana Bash looked with incredulity at a Trump supporter who was claiming that Manafort really had nothing to do with the campaign. And they both said, we were there. We worked with him. And Anderson said, it's too bad we don't have proof of that. Oh, but we do. And they played a montage of all the many times Trump and others on the campaign boasted about how Manafort was running the campaign. So why would they be so backpedaling now? Tell us a little bit more about Manafort's relationship with the pro-Russian forces in Ukraine.
So two questions there. I mean, the reason they're backpedaling now quite obviously is the fact that he has the most explicit relationships to Russia and the highest position within the campaign of essentially anyone that's being looked at here. So he, over the course of his career, has been a consultant, and he consulted with the Russia-backed president of Ukraine on a couple of campaigns, at one point even levying the charge that he was worried that the campaign was going to be stolen, in an echo of the arguments that Donald Trump himself made last year. It eventually turned out there were allegations made that there was this secret listing of payments to various people, and his name came up in the secret listing. People may remember that the pro-Russia president of Ukraine, he had this huge estate that was swarmed at the moment that he lost power, and people found these secret documents that listed all these illicit payments. If I remember correctly, that was the thing that triggered Manafort being firing, the fact that his name was mentioned in those documents.
Well, but there's also deep suspicion, because in mid-July, the Republican platform was changed. This had to do with a plank that had been in there to help Ukraine, which had overthrown the president that Paul Manafort advised. And that help from the United States was softened. And that's what everybody zeroes in on.
Yes, that is what people zero in on as evidence of Russia's influence over the Trump campaign. So, yes, there was this plank in the Republican Party platform, which wanted to arm, essentially, Ukrainians against Russia. That was removed, apparently, at the behest, as the Washington Post reported at the time, at the behest of the Trump campaign itself. The Trump campaign denied that, but eventually a man named J.D. Gordon, he was an advisor to the campaign, although he was sort of on the outskirts of the universe of Trump associates. He admitted to having had a role in that. But this was probably the first concrete example of Russia being able to influence things within the Trump campaign, which I think is one of the reasons that people isolate that as a moment of particular importance.
Well, then take us to Carter Page. Remember, it's in mid-June that the disclosure is made that the DNC has been hacked. In July, Carter Page made a trip to Russia. And again, Adam Schiff, the Democrat from California, mentioned his concerns with Page yesterday.
In early July, Carter Page, someone candidate Trump identified as one of his national security advisors, travels to Moscow on a trip approved by the Trump campaign. While in Moscow, he gives a speech critical of the United States and other Western countries for what he believes is a hypocritical focus on democratization and efforts to fight corruption.
Who is Carter Page?
So Carter Page is a somewhat murky figure in relation to Donald Trump's campaign. He was identified as a foreign policy advisor fairly early in the effort. Once it became known that he sort of had this background which overlapped with Russia, the campaign distanced themselves from him. He had been an investment banker in Russia. He'd actually lived and worked there for some time. I mentioned earlier that Paul Manafort was the highest up person with the closest ties to Russia. Carter Page has probably closer ties to Russia, but was fairly out on the periphery of the relationship with the Trump campaign. But simply by virtue of the fact that he made the comments that you just heard Representative Schiff refer to, makes him a focus of a lot of this attention. And also because it's not really clear how he ended up on the foreign policy team. And that, I think, also adds a level of mystery about him, which I think Trump's opponents have seized upon.
Look, we've just sort of broad-brushed each of these people. It goes much deeper. As you well know, there's the dossier from Christopher Steele, the British British former intelligence officer who was gathering intelligence. He claims that Russian sources told him that Carter Page had secret meetings with people who reported to Putin, that he was offered brokerage fees, that, you know, this can go down quite a rabbit hole. But do you think this is going to be pulled apart?
I think it's important to remember that Congress is controlled by Republicans and that Republicans, for the first time, essentially since 2003, have a unified Capitol, have control of the House, have control of the Senate, and have a president who can sign legislation into law. They are going to be unwilling to target that president, especially a president who has a very strong vocal core of support for detailed investigations. They certainly could. It's unlikely they will, particularly when what they have to work with is a lot of smoke and not much evidence of many fires.
But what about the FBI? They are, you know, have had an ongoing investigation since July. You'd think you'd recognize something was smoke in that amount of time.
That's true. They have had this investigation going on for a long time. But as Comey pointed out, in the scale of national security investigations, the amount of time they've spent on it so far is actually not that long. That these are detailed, complex investigations that take place over over an extended period of time. Who knows? That may end up with something. But it's hard to say in advance.
That's Philip Bump, national correspondent for The Washington Post. Philip, thank you.
Of course, my pleasure.
You may have noticed that there are a lot of different varieties of rice on the shelves of your local supermarket. But have you been afraid to try them, or have you even wanted to try them? Well, here and now, resident chef Kathy Gunst has been exploring the many kinds and uses of rice, and she joins us now. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, Jeremy, this is all true.
This is all true. There's a lot of varieties of rice out there.
There sure are. More than 40,000 varieties, which is a crazy number, and I will not take you through all of them. But here's some of the more popular varieties of rice. So before I tell you about this, though, I just need to give you a rice factoid,
okay,
which is that there are three edible parts to a grain of rice. There's the bran, which is the outer husk. There's the germ, and then there's the endosperm. And this becomes important later on. So the most common rice, the rice you see virtually everywhere, is white rice. And that has the husk, the bran, and the germ removed before you buy it in the store. It clearly has a lot less nutrients, but it's super adaptable for cooking with because it's a very dry and fluffy texture. I love to use white rice, whether it's leftover from a Chinese restaurant or from cooking at my house, in a stir-fried rice using lots of vegetables, and I make a sesame oil-flavored omelet that I chop up into the fried rice. Really easy recipe and a great way to use white rice or any variety of rice.
And tell us about some of the other varieties. I think the most common after white rice has got to be brown rice, right?
Yeah, brown rice has the bran and the germ layers left intact. And what's fabulous about brown rice is the nutty, chewy texture. It takes twice as long to cook as white rice, but I love it. It's interchangeable with white rice, but it does have a bit of a texture, which I like, and some don't.
I am looking right in front of me at something with black rice.
Yeah, black rice I never knew about until recently. It's an ancient grain that was once reserved for the emperors of China. Really pleasing, nutty, almost a roasted taste. And it has a beautiful dark purple black color. Very, very healthy. It's also called longevity rice, high in fiber. And we made a beautiful salad with this black rice that is a real favorite. So this is a warm black rice salad. It's got apricots, almonds, raisins, and radicchio, which is a bitter red lettuce. So it's got this great combination of sweet, bitter, and savory, the nutty texture of the rice, and all these beautiful colors that pop out of the drama of that black rice.
It really, I must say, tastes delicious, but also kind of healthy.
It is healthy, but like it's not healthy like, oh, this is healthy, but I don't want to eat it. It's a really pleasing texture and flavor.
Well, as I wrap up my longevity rice there, which is very delicious, let's move on to another kind of rice that you have made into a dish here, basmati rice.
Basmati rice is so delicious. It's a long, slender grain, very aromatic and fragrant. It's often soaked before it's cooked, and it's found a lot in Indian foods. But I like to use it for Indian spiced rice pudding, which is my version of rice pudding. I add fresh ginger and cardamom, and it gives rice pudding, which is like a real childhood comfort food, a kind of exotic twist. And then I add pistachio nuts to give it a crunch. They're in the rice pudding along with the yellow raisins and the ginger and cardamom, and then you sprinkle them on the top. It's a really elegant dessert that takes not very long to make.
It really makes you think in a different way about rice to taste these flavors in the rice.
Well, rice is extremely adaptable. It's like a neutral. So when you add things, it really absorbs those flavor. So in the case of this rice pudding, you get the ginger, you get the cardamom, there's the creaminess of the milk in there, and then that crunch of the pistachio nuts. Rice really lets other flavors show off, but it also lets other flavors help it taste more interesting.
Now, can you get all of these different varieties of rice at any store, or do you have to go to a specialty store?
It depends. I mean, like there's arborio rice, which you use for risotto. That's in grocery stores now. If you wanted Japanese sushi rice, you might have to go to a specialty food store. But more and more, you're finding many varieties of rice in regular old grocery stores. Jasmine rice, which is also called Thai fragrant rice. I see that all the time. That's got a wonderful floral flavor. And it's really fun to try new rices and swap out flavors and see how it changes your same old dishes in terms of a new texture and a new flavor.
What about people who are on low-carb diets? Because, you know, Kathy, you and I just recently talked about pasta, and now we're on to rice. What's next? Where are you going to bring us next? Bread, potatoes?
Definitely have to do a bread segment. Rice is gluten-free. It is a symbol of fertility in Asia, and rice can be incredibly healthy for you. It can be a whole grain protein, a lot of iron, and it is a carb that actually fuels you with energy as opposed to a carb that brings you down and makes you feel tired the way sometimes you can feel after a big bowl of pasta. So this is a good carb and very low in fat.
That's Kathy Gunst, our resident chef, and we will link you to the recipes for some very interesting takes on rice at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thanks.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.